Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Morales, and I'm so glad to be here with Dr. Edward C. Valandra, Wambli Wapaha Hoxila, editor of Colorizing Restorative Justice, Voicing Our Realities, a Living Justice Press book released in June of 2020. Dr. Valandra is Sikonju Fithwana and was born and raised on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. He has served in the Sikonju Fithwana Thunhuan, Oyate Nation on the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Council as an Intertribal Bison Cooperative, ITBC, Board of Directors Representative, and as his nation's seven-member constitutional task force. He holds a PhD in American Studies with a concentration in Native Studies in SUNY Buffalo. He has taught at both Native and non-Native colleges and universities and centered his research on the national revitalization of the Ocheti Waksakowin Oyate, people of the Seven Fires, commonly called the Lakota people, and the development of Native Studies. Dr. Valandra is founder and research fellow of the Community for the Advancement of Native Studies, CANS, a Native government-chartered, research-based, reservation-rooted organization, and has served as an advisor to Living Justice Press on Native understandings of justice and this in application towards restorative justice repair. Colorizing Restorative Justice consists of stories that have arisen from the lived experiences of a broad range of seasoned, loving restorative justice practitioners of color, mostly women who have fiercely unearthed realities about devastation caused by white practitioners who have unthinkably worked without a racial and social justice consciousness. This book is thus a wake-up call for European-descended restorative justice practitioners, as it validates Indigenous practitioners and practitioners of color, and is enlightening for anyone wishing to explore the intersections of indigeneity, racial justice, and restorative justice. Dr. Valandra, I am so glad to meet with you today and discuss your book, Colorizing Restorative Justice, Voicing Our Realities. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, before we delve into Colorizing Restorative Justice, would you mind beginning by saying a few words about yourself, your research, and your connection with Colorizing Restorative Justice, Voicing Our Realities?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in the great historic Sioux Nation. That's the colonizing term, but we call ourselves the Ocheti Shakonwe, people of the Seven Fires. Myself, I am from one of the fires, a Tituwan fire, and of that I am Sichanghu Lakota. Again, you know, educated in the public school systems, which on our reserves are quite substandard in terms of academic achievement and things like that. But I think my journey to get to restorative justice has been a long one. At times people would ask how I came into it. And my response has been that being Indigenous, particularly in my homelands, we are born into restorative justice of how we relate to each other. It's not always perfect, of course, but the notion of circles, the notion of relationships is constantly there. Kinship systems are constantly forefront. So my thing is, I was born into restorative justices or restorative practices. So though I've been born into it, I guess as a field or as a discipline, I've just come into it in the last 15 to 17 years.
Thank you so much. That's very informative. And these lead perfectly into your questions on colorizing restorative justice. So the first question I want to ask is if you could explain to our audience the meaning behind the book's cover, painting by Herman Red Elk, Ihan Thunwana Ochetti Sokawin Oyate's 1963 buffalo hide painting of a Black war bonnet and its representation of these five themes: indigenous, circle, action, authenticity, and emergence.
Well, you know, the buffalo robe itself is a traditional way of recording events within our Teochpai, or the extended family. So back in the day, about every extended family had one of these buffalo robes, and they usually painted events. And so the buffalo robe is a mnemonic device that we use to record our history. So it was just not one buffalo robe, but several families had them. And so they often recorded a significant event that had happened during that year. And so that was part of our oral tradition in terms of recording and remembering. And this buffalo robe in particular, we searched high and low for a cover for the book, and we wanted to ensure that it represented the indigenous roots of restorative justice. And we found this Herman Red Elk. And of course, we had to pay a copyright for it. But again, you know, what was striking about that cover, it does represent, it's circular. But when you take one of our headdresses, which, you know, whites, our most non-natives call a war bonnet, but if you take it and you spread it out, it does necessarily form a circle. And so we thought that was very representative of, you know, restorative practices. And really, you know, again, it just reminds people that circles that are used in restorative justice or restorative practices does have an indigenous root to it. And of course, the symbolism of the headdress, you know, leaders back in the day, you know, pre-contact and some contact, I think those leaders often, those headdresses often represented stability and really said something about the person. In contrast to today, leaders today, you have to have money, you have to have connections, you have to have a name. There's so many external things to define a leader. But how we understood a leader was that person that put the best interest of the people before his or her own. And of course, there were a lot of cultural understandings about that, you know, being generous, being humble. Those are the kind of attributes that our leadership had and people looked for. So we thought that particular book cover was going to be very symbolic about what we're saying in the book. You know, a lot of agency, a lot of action, a lot of grassroots people, practitioners in the trenches. And that's basically what leaders do. They are at ground zero with their community.
As this relates to the five parts of the book, as they mirror this painting, I want to state the five parts. One, restorative justice, restorative practice, challenges and obligations. Two, negotiating restorative justice and practice as professionals of color, POC. Three, POC experiences of restorative justice, restorative practice, and circle work. And four, restorative lessons from within the community. And five, last, a call to settlers and restorative justice. Is there more that you could state on this painting as it relates to these five parts and the contributors who were chosen to write in each part?
Oh, that's an excellent question, and it's very substantive too. We need about a week to really get through that. But you know, the thing about the people that have contributed to the book, there was a time that we were wondering how to go about this. We knew we wanted to have people of color and indigenous people come forward and step forward. So we had put a call out for colorizing restorative justice. And we weren't sure what kind of response we would get back to that. And so we put out the call for articles or essays. And I think that was in 2017, in the fall of 2017. And we held our breath. We put the call out, we waited, and about 64 abstracts came in. And we were really shocked and surprised, but also delighted by that kind of response. And so then, of course, we really had to sit down. And that was a collective effort. I organized a committee. We went through that process, and it was very difficult. But we ended up with these 20 authors to then contribute to the book. So that was one of the really, I think, inspiring things for me as the editor of the book, that we had such a great response, more than we expected. And then we settled on these 20 authors, and then we began the process. And, you know, a lot of good abstracts that came in, you know, these were abstracts that were submitted initially, and we went through them. And then we went through the selection process, and it was by no means easy, to be honest with you. You know, there was just some really, really good abstracts, but we went through it, and we ended up with these 20 authors. And of course, we went through the manuscript process. We copy edited it. We made suggestions. It was a back and forth process. And when we talk about how we did this, I made a commitment, and LJP agreed with this. We wanted to reach out to the contributors. So we had a very nice friend of mine. His name is Alex Goff. He organized several Zoom sessions where the contributors would get together, and we would just talk, you know, about what was going on in our life. And we wanted to build that kind of community. So one of the really nice aspects of this project was to go ahead and engage our contributors, you know, not just receive their articles and do the edits and send them back, but we wanted to know what was going on in each other's lives. Some people experienced loved one passing away. Others experienced, you know, becoming parents. Others experienced transition. So this group of 20, we would meet, and we would, you know, we couldn't all meet at once, but those that could attend, and it varied from, you know, Zoom meeting to Zoom meeting, but it was really good to just hear what their journeys were while they were writing their articles. And so I think those five areas that we have in the table of contents, and plus what the cover really represented, was how do you make community? And that was critical to us in terms of circles. For us, circles is core. The core thing about the circles are the relationships that we established. And we have continued with this process. Although the book has been done, we still talk. We try to get together. And there's been some really interesting things that have come out of that. Some of the contributors have, started their own little webinar series, or have invited other contributors from the book to hold a webinar on the book itself. So there's been some really exciting developments as a result of building this community as well as publishing the book.
Thank you. That's very informative to hear. And moving on to the introduction, I wanted to focus on the statement that was made in the introduction, but encompasses the whole. So from a love of deeper than most whites can imagine, as authors of color, we are taking the risk to share openly and honestly what we have experienced while working in restorative justice. So here, to whom here might we define as white, and how might this categorization intertwine itself and or set apart from other provided terms such as settler, apologist, and ally?
Okay, well, that statement has really caught the attention of a lot of people, and it's been commented on because it comes almost in the first part of the book in the introduction. And I just wanted to make clear that the articles in this book are just not stories about being co-opted and some of the problems that we face, but that these contributors, they come from a place of love and toward a place of love. And to say that deeper than most whites can imagine, because communities of color of indigenous people have been at the receiving end of colonization, oppression, racism. And that experience is something we all have, though we're all unique in our communities. All communities are unique. We do have that common sense of oppression and experience of oppression in particular. And yet when you hear things about restorative justice, like undoing the harms as a result of wrongdoing, that can only come from a place of love, toward a place of love. And so it was important to put that in there to remind people that as you read this particular book, that is where the contributors are coming from. And the risk, of course, is there, because every one of us has written in such a way that we have this vulnerability as a result of that exposure. And I really have to, again, say that the contributors are really speaking from experience and the relationships with white people, and how that impacts us as individuals, how it impacts us as communities, and in my particular case, how that impacts us as a nation, an indigenous nation. So it was really important to recognize that, coming from a place of love, toward a place of love, involves risk, involves vulnerabilities. And I really have to say these authors have really given themselves that exposure, because I am sure it's going to generate a lot of discussion, good and bad. And I think that's fine. I think that discussion has to happen, particularly in the timing of this book. I mean, my gosh, this was a 3-year project, and it was a lot of back and forth. When you edit a book with as many as 20 contributors, it is a process, and you can set deadlines and you can really talk, but the process was organic, and people moved toward completing their manuscripts and getting them in. But I think the timing of this book is almost It's phenomenal. I mean, it came at a time, and it was published at a time when things really started heating up, or is heating up in the United States. And so this is one of many voices that's out there now and talking about, you know, racism, how it manifests, being co-opted in that process. So I'm really struck by how the timing of the book came out and coincided with a lot of the events that we're seeing and experiencing in the United States. And it's not over yet either. I'd hate to say that, but, you know, things are going to really demand that people step into those roles of doing restorative justice or restorative practices.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And as we move on, could you speak more on the decolonization of restorative practices and restorative justice as discussed in Chapter 2 by Barbara Sherrod and called out in Part 2, and the need for learning from professionals of color, especially in Kansas states, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States?
You know, when we're talking about, you know, decolonization is really a word that has gotten some traction in the United States. And you know, so I think when we talk about decolonization, people have to reorient their compasses a little bit, because, you know, as speaking as an Indigenous person, we are still being colonized, and I use the term settler quite a bit. And I think when we talk to, you know, one of the things that has caught my attention is that what is decolonization in a lot of ways? What does that really mean? And what does that look like? So again, as an Indigenous person, we are still colonized by settlers. It's called settler colonialism. And for us to decolonize, you know, and I think this is true for people of color in so many different ways and so many different manifestations. In order to decolonize, what harms have to be undone as a result of wrongdoing? So that's out there. And the thing that I got most from Barbara Sherrod's article, and it was good, but I do recall, you know, she talked about co-powering circles. Like how does that look so that Indigenous people and people of color can equally share that burden of talking about the harms and trying to undo those harms as a result of wrongdoing? And I think what I get from that article is that me as an Indigenous person, I need to listen to my Black brothers and sisters' stories. They need to listen to mine. I need to listen to the Latinx brothers and sisters' stories. And we have to listen to all these stories. without any kind of mediation, in terms of just sitting in those circles and listening. And I think that begins the building process of relationships. I think people of color and indigenous people, like I say, we're unique communities, but we all experience oppression. And we need to hear those stories. And we need to really find out what are those commonalities that we share, as well as those differences. And I think that becomes the exciting part of what Barbara was talking about in her book about co-powering circles. Like, how do we come into this and recognize each other's, the harms that have been committed, you know, through white supremacy, through settler colonization? Those discussions really need to happen. When we were doing the book and we did have our Zoom sessions, I always felt energized, and I'm sure the other contributors did too. We always felt energized and affirmed, so that I think that part of the decolonization process of who we are as individuals and as peoples and what we went through. And it's not so much commiserating, but we also see the value and the strength that each of our communities have. And that to me is part of what decolonization is. We learn so much from each other, you know, beyond just what we read in, let's say, Black studies or Asian American studies, Latinx studies, and all these different kind of areas. I think to see the human element is such a empowering kind of relationship or dialogue that you have. You know, one of the things that I'm sure our listeners will agree with, when you get people of color together, there is so much humor that goes on. And humor is our way of showing how much human we are, and that despite what we've experienced in terms of oppression, the humor we have is the thing that really helps us with our struggles and really helps bridge our communities together. I enjoy getting with the contributors, and I think this is a general understanding that our humor is one of those signatures that we have. And, you know, in our circles could probably use a lot more humor, to be honest with you. It's a way of showing that despite the oppression we have, we still can laugh about things, or we can still take joy in some of the things that happen in our community. I mean, so yeah.
And focusing on part five in regard to words on harm that is being done to trivializing indigenous culture and sports mascots and Native Nations names to military hardware, could you provide additional insight into this section and elsewhere in regard to the harm done in normalizing settler violence against indigenous communities?
Okay, so when I was doing my chapter, I talked about settlers and restorative justice. And one of the challenges I put out there was that as an indigenous person who would sit in a circle with settlers, for example, I think the challenge that I put out there is this. If restorative justice is about undoing harms as a result of wrongdoing, what do we do about the first harm? And that's what I call it, the first harm. This historic and ongoing harm of land theft and genocide. As an indigenous person sitting in circle with settlers, and while they're trying to undo harms, my question is, what about the first harm? What about that very first harm? And I would, and I propose that if we don't deal with this first harm, then what is the value or the validity of restorative justice? I mean, I mentioned in the book that, you know, maybe as people, as parents, we can tell our children that stealing is wrong, but yet, what about a whole continent that was stolen? I think that's the introspection that we have to do when we're in these circles with settlers. Like, how can you talk about undoing harms when you've stolen native land? And today, I mean, this is not a historic thing. This is ongoing today. And genocide, which is ongoing today. Look at the disparities we have in the COVID-19 epidemic. Who's getting treated? Who's got access? So those are the things that we have to look at. And then, you know, my Black brothers and sisters, what about the theft of their labor, the theft of their bodies? I mean, we see that playing out in contemporary and 21st century U.S. And so those are the questions we really have to drill down and say, if we don't address those initial harms, then what are we doing with restorative justice? And I think that becomes a very core philosophical question for everyone in the U.S. because those two harms have led to so many other harms. And it's not just historic, it is still ongoing. And so we really have to talk about that. And what we see happening in the U.S. today, I think, is a manifestation of not having those two harms addressed. Maybe just one other thing about the trivializing of indigenous culture. I know the Washington Redskins had decided to change their name from Redskins to, I guess so far, the Washington football team. But those mascots are indicative of the trivialization of indigenous cultures, norms, values, and practices. And of course, the naming of items like military hardware after indigenous nations, Tomahawk cruise missile, or the Apache helicopter. Those are saying something about indigenous peoples being perhaps hostile. I mean, that's one of the things that comes to mind. And of course, having mascots, you know, when you're able to take a people, and this happened in Germany under Hitler's regime, when you're able to trivialize a people in such a way and defame them in such a way, you expose them in a way that makes them very vulnerable. So it wouldn't be hard then to say, well, we dehumanize indigenous peoples through mascots and other names and labeling them so then that their culture means nothing. We've trivialized it to a point where who they are as human beings is not important. And then we can almost do anything we want with them. So there's a dehumanizing effect to trivializing indigenous peoples that way. So that's one of the things that I think we need to talk about. And those discussions are happening, I guess, in today's climate. People are starting to ask those questions and rethink what it means. You know, statues are coming down of the Confederacy, and people are really rethinking some of the most cherished icons that they've embraced. And so we're in this, one would call it a cultural war, trying to understand what the narratives are what the dominant narrative is. So, and so I think having this discussion on mascots and other things is a good thing. It's difficult. It's perhaps painful, but it's a good thing.
Thank you. And is there anything that you could speak further on to practitioners, teachers, families, and communities in utilizing colorizing restorative justice chapter questions and activities to work to heal the wound of the first harm? Is there more that you could provide on that or that you would like to say on that?
Well that's, one of the things when we were designing the book, to give the book some legs, we just didn't want people to submit articles. We've asked that in the call that they ask, they put discussion questions in, they put activities in, they put resources in, because we want to, I felt that we needed to have this book just not sit on a shelf, but actually become somewhat of a field manual, so that although people read the contributors' essays, there's things in the back that can help them and questions that they can utilize to get a start. And maybe some of these questions would be used in circles. So we wanted that to happen. And I think because we done that book does have, I think, a very practical part to it, other than just reading the articles themselves. We've given them, you read the activities and the questions. I think those are things that are really going to give the book a lot of staying power. And we designed it that way. And I think, when we talk about the practitioner, especially the people of color, one of the things that we did in a call was to say, look, where's the restorative justice movement now? What has been your experience in restorative justice? And there's issues of being co-opted that was talked about. And just being able to articulate our experiences in restorative justice, I think is obviously going to lead to further discussions and perhaps even disagreements about what was said in the book. I'm sure, and it's been my experience since a book has come out, and prior to that, when I talk about like settler colonialism, that, for example, the logic of settler colonialism is the elimination, the logic of elimination. And I think a lot of settlers become unsettled when they hear that. Like, it's structural and it's systemic. And it is so... It is so embedded and so normalized, people don't even think about it. I'll just give you one example that a good friend of mine, Dr. Kay Holmes, had a really good exercise. And it's an exercise that I think really brings home the point of why this book is important. The exercise involves asking people, what is the first thing they do in the morning when they get out of bed? And when you ask that question of people in a circle or in a group, you're going to get answers like, well, I make coffee. Well, I go running. I read. I meditate. But the response to that is, well, I really know, I exactly know what you settlers do. in the morning, the first thing you do when you get out of bed is you step on stolen native land. That's the first thing you do. And the reaction is angst. The reaction is denial. The reaction is, well, my parents came in 1975 and not, 1775. And so that question, then when you think about that question and drill down, yeah, the first thing you do as settlers, the first thing you do in the morning when you get out of bed is you step on stolen native land. The fact that they don't even think about that tells us how normalized the violence has been against indigenous peoples. And one of the things that I had asked about in the book is this talking piece. I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but I did offer something for restorative justice in terms of the talking piece. And maybe that's one way to remind settlers that we are still the owners of this land, regardless of what anyone says, particularly American history, white history. This land is stolen. There was and is genocide committed. And that exists in the 21st century. And it's been so normalized, people don't even think about it. And so that one question is a way of getting people to understand how pervasive settler violence has been and structured into institutions and ways of thinking that people don't even think about it. Genocide is normalized against indigenous peoples. So those are hard discussions to have. And I talk about that in my chapter about settlers being in restorative justice. It's a call to action.
Thank you so much, Dr. Valandra. Wanhible, wahaha, hoxila. I really appreciated this in-depth look into colorizing restorative justice, voicing our realities. It's been very informative. And there is a lot to learn from this book. And I highly recommend it to our audience and educators. And before we take any more of your time, might you provide our audience with a bit of what you're currently researching, working on at this time, anything further that we could know?
Well, I've been looking at a couple of things. One is I have a book project that's been ongoing for quite some time, and it has to deal with the state of South Dakota and my people back in 1964, when the state of South Dakota literally tried to dismantle and terminate indigenous governance. We stopped that process, but that story has never been told. And I think that's one of the things that I want to do is tell that story. In terms of numbers, we're a small population in the state of South Dakota. And at that time in the 60s, the state legislature was all white. South Dakota has been a Republican state since its inception. So there's very conservative white settlers there. And there was a movement to just dismantle our native governance. And we stopped that. We were outsourced, outnumbered, but we were able to stop that takeover. And that's a project I've been working on for quite some time. And I would like to finish. So that's one. I've also spent 4 years in K-12 education, Native education, as an administrator. And those 4 years have been, what an experience. I want to write about Native educational leadership and base that upon my experience, because I do see a lot of internalized colonization going on within my own nation. And that's systemic and structural. And we participate in it in a way that damages our children, in ways that damages people that work in these native schools, particularly in my homeland, and the toxicity of that colonization gets played out on a lateral level. And so I want to really talk about that because I think it's important for why the state of education is the way it is in our homelands. I mean, we can have all kinds of different solutions, but unless we actually address what it is we're doing as Lakota people and adopting these westernized systems, the evidence is there. Our children struggle. There's an educational disparity. And even rethinking the whole idea of education itself. So those are just a couple of things that I'm looking at. And then, of course, being with the Living Justice Press, we're maybe looking at doing a colorizing restorative justice series. I'm not saying that's what we'll do, but we're thinking about that. And we're always looking for manuscripts from communities of color, indigenous people that talk about restorative justice in a way that we feel is edgy, that we feel is... comes from what, from a lens of experience. And so that, so those are a couple of things that I, at least I'm working on. It keeps me busy.
Thank you. And I know a lot of our audience will be very interested in contacting you and finding more about that. Thank you so much, Dr. Valandra. Wanhible, Wahaha, Hoxila, for being on New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and for providing our audience wisdom on colorizing restorative justice, voicing our realities. I've really enjoyed our time.
Me too. I really want to thank you for, the listening audience doesn't realize, but we've been trying to connect for a while, only because of the fires out in California. So, it's been such a pleasure, and this is the first interview that I've done with respect to colorizing restorative justice. So I was a bit nervous and I, a play on words here. I don't know if I've done justice to my contributors, but they're a very loving and understanding group of people. So It's been a really good journey for me as the editor, and then I think for the contributors, and I really appreciate you having me on. I'm thankful, very thankful.